Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are standing at the tomb of the unknown soldier in Arlington National Cemetery. The President of the United States is here to pay tribute to the nation's honored dead 17 years after the end of the World War. And now, the President's wreath is being laid at the base of the tomb of the unknown soldier. And now, the wreath of Mrs. Roosevelt. And now, the President is turning, and he's coming back right alongside of us, and will make his way into the amphitheater, where in a few moments he will address the enormous crowd which has gathered there to hear him this morning.
I now have the honor to present the President of the United States. My fellow Americans, the living memory of the world war is close to each and every one of us today. Our thoughts return to the great objectives of the past, even as the minds of older men go back to their boyhood ideals. We Americans were so placed in those days that we gained a perspective of the great world conflict that was perhaps clearer than that of our fellow men who were closer to the scene of battle. For most of the first 3 years of the conflict, we were not participants. But during the final phase, we ourselves engaged on many fronts. For that reason, perhaps, we understood as well as any the cries that went up that the world conflict should be made a war to end war. We were not invaded. Nor were we threatened with invasion, then or later. But the very distance of our view led us to perceive the dire results of war through days of following peace. The primary purpose of the United States of America is to avoid being drawn into war. We seek also, in every practicable way, to promote peace and to discourage war. Except for those few who have placed or who place temporary, selfish gain ahead of national and world peace, the overwhelming mass of American citizens are in hearty accord with these basic policies of our government, as they are also entirely sympathetic with the efforts of other nations to avoid and to end war. So, my friends, that is why we too have striven with great consistency to approve steps to remove the causes of war and to disapprove steps taken by others to commit acts of aggression. We have either led or performed our full part in every important attempt to limit and to reduce world armament. We have sought by definite acts and solemn commitment to establish the United States as a good neighbor among nations. We are active to simplify definition and fact by calling war war when armed invasion and the resulting killing of human beings take place. But though our course is consistent and clear, it is with disappointment and sorrow that most Americans confess that the world's gain thus far has been small. I would not be frank with you if I did not tell you that the dangers that confront the future of mankind are, as a whole, greater to the world and therefore to us than the dangers that confront the people of the United States by and in themselves alone. Jealousies between nations continue. Armaments increase. National ambitions that disturb the world's peace are thrust forward. And the most serious of all, international confidence in the sacredness of international contracts is on the wane. The memory of our hope of 1917 and of 1918 dies with the death of those of us who took part. It is therefore your sacred obligation and mine, by conscious, definite effort, to pass that great memory on to succeeding generations. A new generation, even in its cradle or still unborn, is coming to the fore. The children in our schools, the young men and women passing through our colleges into productive life, have, unlike us, no direct knowledge of the meaning of war. They are not immune to the glamour of war, to the opportunities to escape, which may come from a new war, must lead, for those who survive it, to economic and social collapse more sweeping than any we have experienced in the past. While, therefore, we cannot and must not hide our concern for grave world danger, and while at the same time we cannot and must not build walls round ourselves and hide our heads in the sand, we must go forward with all our strength to stress and strive for international peace. And in this effort, America must and will protect herself. Under no circumstances will this policy of self-protection go to lengths beyond self-protection. Aggression on the part of the United States is an impossibility insofar as the present administration of your government is concerned. But defense against aggression by others, adequate defense on land, on sea, and in air, is our accepted policy. And the measure of that defense is and will be solely the amount necessary to guard us, to safeguard us against the armament of others. The more greatly they decrease their armament, the more quickly and surely shall we decrease ours. In many other fields, by word and by deed, We are giving example to the world by removing or lowering barriers which impede friendly intercourse. Our soldier and sailor death call to us across the years to make our lives effective in building constructively for peace. And it is fitting that on this armistice day, 17 years late, I am privileged to tell you that between us and a great neighbor, another act cementing our historic friendship has been agreed upon and is being consummated. Between Canada and the United States exists a neighborliness, a genuine friendship, which for over a century has dispelled every passing rift. Our two people, each independent in themselves, are closely knit by ties of blood and a common heritage. Our standards of life are substantially the same. Our commerce, our economic conditions rest upon the same foundation. Between two such people, if we would build constructively for peace and progress, the flow of intercourse should be mutually beneficial and not unduly hampered. Each has much to gain by material profit, by spiritual profit, by increased employment, through the means of enlarged trade one with the other. And I am therefore happy to be able to tell you, almost in celebration of this armistice day, that the Canadian Prime Minister and I, after thoughtful discussion of our national problems, have reached a definite agreement which will eliminate disagreements and unreasonable restrictions, and thus work to the advantage of both Canada and the United States. I hope that this good example will reach round the world someday. For the power of good example is the strongest force in the world. It surpasses preachment. It excels good resolutions. And it is far better than agreement unfulfilled. If we as a nation, by our good example, can contribute to the peaceful well-being of the fellowship of nations, our course through the years will not have been in vain. We who survive have profited by the good example of our fellow Americans who gave their lives in war. On these surrounding hills of Virginia, they rest, thousands upon thousands, in the last bivouac of the dead. Below us, across the river, we see a great capital of a great nation. The past and the present unite in the prayer that America will ever seek the ways of peace, and by her example, at home and abroad, feed the return of goodwill among men.